Where is it?
Voice memo.
Where is it, though?
From Super High Quality Productions, this is a special Super High Quality 10th Anniversary look back at the War on Drugs 2014 album, Lost in the Dream.
Okay, make sure we've got the mic on this end. Yep. This is good quality, you think?
We'll find out.
Two, 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 two.
Well, it's hard to believe it's been 10 years since Lost in the Dream came out. And to commemorate the anniversary, we're going to look back and tell the behind-the-scenes story of what it took to make an album that topped so many year-end lists in 2014. We'll hear from the people who made the record, and with a little help from Dave's Google Calendar and checking some old emails, we're going to rewind the tapes.
So I should stop my iPad?
Don't stop your
iPad. I'll stop it.
Don't stop
it. I'll stop it quick. Stopping iPad. We should bleep out the name every time someone says beep.
Noted.
We'll grab the liner notes because we're going to cover a lot of ground as we tell this story. We're going to mention a lot of people's names who you may not be familiar with, because records are made by a huge group of people, not just the people you're used to seeing on stage with the band. The engineers, outside musicians, friends, sometimes even neighbors, anyone who could provide a spark that moves the process forward. And records are also a document of the time when they were made, and inevitably, that means they're a reflection of the people who made them in that moment. So with that in mind, let's go back to 2013 and learn how the War on Drugs began the process of making this record.
January 4th, 2013, 11:23 p.m., famous night owl, Adam, sent this email. Hey everyone, we're all booked for February 19th, 20th, and 21st at Water Music in Hoboken. Shit's gonna rule. Obviously, it's a ways away, but wanted to let y'all know it was confirmed more soon. Nice. Classic Adam email parlance there.
When was Hurricane Sandy? Fall of 2012?
2012, yeah.
John Agnello was mixing the Thermals record up until the moment that the water started coming in. They shut down and then they reopened in, January of 2013. We were the first band. There was fresh drywall. It kind of smelled a little bit like mold.
Yeah, a little mildewy.
The tape machines were gutted. Those were ruined. Each day someone was bringing in a fixed piece of gear and then leaving with another broken piece of gear. So we set up, it was myself, the first couple of days, me, Robbie, Dave, Pat Berkery, and maybe the Here We Go Magic guys were hanging around too for a bit.
Peter came down.
Mike Block was there, and Jeff Ziegler was engineering. The first day I remember it was just just trying to figure out which mic cables worked and which DIs worked, just because nothing had really been gone through since they reopened. But I think at the time there was maybe five songs that I had been worked on the 1-inch machine. I don't really think much of it really kept. I mean, we did a version of Suffering, Eyes of the Wind with Peter from Here We Go Magic on drums in reverse, and then Red Eyes and Pressure, both of which the drums from Pat on Red Eyes and Charlie on Pressure were the album takes. But that was all there really was those five or six tunes. We stayed overnight. I remember they had like lodging upstairs, and it was cool. It was pretty low key session. I don't think Pat came up with us, but he was definitely there on the first day. So I don't think he drove with us, but he might have driven separate. But yeah, he was there.
He was deep in there.
And then I think maybe the Charlie came the second day, because I knew, I was like, oh, this Under the Pressure song would be cool for Charlie.
Yeah, Pat and I drove up together, and, you know, with like a car full of, I don't know, car full of drums and guitars and whatever else. And I remember AG, I think, he was like, oh, I made this loop. It's going to be killer. I want you to play to it. And that ended up, I think, being like the Pressure basics.
Working there because you could set the whole band up and you could set up stations, and which is something we hadn't really done before when tracking. It was exciting. It was sort of like it was so early on the process, but like Under the Pressure, I'd already done a lot of work on at home, and surprisingly, I don't remember much from those sessions other than cutting the basics. I don't know what else we really did. Was the bass from there, too?
Red Eyes bass is from there.
Red Eyes bass, right. It was cut with Pat, yeah.
I think Red Eyes piano was there, too.
No, Red Eyes piano was from Ziegler's. The night before we went to mix it.
I remember being very cold there.
It was, yeah, it was cold in there.
You know, I remember it being pretty unpleasant vibe, actually. No windows, very cold, very dank.
You could smell, like, the mold paint, what's it called? Like,
Kills.
Kills. Yeah, it smelled like kills in there. And, it was a rainy day. It was like, you know, January in Jersey.
Got a flat tire right as we pulled in.
That's right. There was some van drama. That's right.
Pulling into the parking lot, boom, flat tire. We're like, fuck. Then I took the van to get the flat tire fixed, and I ended up on the phone with Kenny Anderson, point guard of the New Jersey Nets.
Was he working at the tire place?
No, but his best friend was also getting a tire fixed, and I was just waiting, and we're talking to this guy, and he's like, you know, my best friend is Kenny Anderson. I was like, cool, really? And he's like, yeah, watch.
Oh my God.
Kenny, talk to this guy. And I was like, what am I going to talk to him about?
I forgot about that. That's right.
Great guy. So it was like kind of a bad omen that led to a good omen.
I like that place because it had great headphone systems and all that stuff. It was just like the wrong time to be working there with all with everything sort of being not functioning. I was just in like a booth with an acoustic and a vocal mic. Wasn't really the most inspired sort of way to record, but I think at that point too, it was just about starting to like start something, you know?
Get the juices flowing.
Yeah, we left there with, I would say Pressure felt like cool. Like everything, I think Eyes of the Wind was weird. In Reverse was like a totally different version of that song. But we left there with roughs of stuff. Nothing was, I think, immediately, obviously, on its way. But I think Red Eyes was cool. The arrangements were a little different, too, because a lot of that happened during mixing. But we kind of did like a pretty loose idea of Red Eyes, like with the rack tom as the snare beat in the verses, and then into the choruses with the snare. I remember thinking of like Candy's Room or something and wanting to do something like that. But the second half of the song wasn't really done, you know? After that, probably got back together with Jeff for a couple weeks, maybe 8 days or something in March, you know, whenever Jeff had time. We would get together at his garage in Philly, right around 13th and Spring Garden. That was just his garage with a control room. And yeah, and just, you know, keep adding, just really just keep adding stuff was name of the game back then.
I feel like I absorbed a lot on the couch during those sessions. Like, I think I just saw a lot of how you just paint.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. If you're not into just hanging out for long, long stretches of time, recording, maybe not for you. It's just part of it, you know? You just, it's just, you can't, you know, it just is. It's just bullshitting.
I mean, every day was the same. You walk into Jeff's, you know, session's supposed to start at 1. 12:30 rolls around, text from Jeff. Yo, can we do 1:30? Yeah, all good. I'm running late too. Like, no problem. 5 minutes later, 2? Cool. And so then 3:30, you go in the garage. NPR's blasting from like the little CD player radio thing, you know, all things considered. Hang out until 6:00. We drive, get in the car, drive to Palm Tree, get a turkey sandwich or some delivery. 7, maybe open a session. DJ night starts at 9, you know? It's like, literally, I swear to God, I was like, 80% of the days we recorded was that thing. You'd be like, all right, well, I just did this guitar. Let's get some noodles.
Yeah, that's a day.
But that's just the way it was. It wasn't like, okay, let's start it. We're going to start at 2 and we're going to work. I mean, it was like just bullshit, you know? And then there's this, we go upstairs and hang out with Mark Munson, Steeringer. I mean, that's inadvertent drums because Mike just lived in the house. So it's like, Mike, can you come down and play on the song quick? You know? Cool. Goes back upstairs, fixing a bike in his room, you know? But it's like, how else are you ever going to get those sorts of things all together? Which is, that's the only way, is you just like live it. Like, you just, you can't go to LA and make a record and like fall into that. You know, it's like you have to just work where you live and work with all your friends and vice versa and live with your friends. And I mean, in the moment, yeah, it's maddening. In retrospect, it's like, obviously awesome experience, blessing to be able to do that. At that point, I probably had like a pretty early version of Disappearing going, because I had gotten that Lindrum from Ben Swanson. That secretly Canadian, he gave me the Lindrum, and I had the power supply rebuilt, although not very well, but enough that it was turned on and worked barely. But I could basically make a quick beat and then loop it with a loop pedal so it would keep working, which is what Disappearing was. for me, it was like at that time, it was very helpful to leave Philadelphia. It was challenging only working at Jeff's for a number of reasons. So if you're trying to immerse yourself in something and you can't, the only way to do it is to like bring everybody, put everybody in a van and go somewhere. Otherwise, you just can't really go deep, you know?
Yo, dudes. So I was talking to Dave and Robbie about this last night. Jeff already knows about it as well. Wanted to book some time at Mitch Easter's studio, the Fidelatorium, to do some basic tracking for the new record. I'd love to start sooner than later so I have time to continually second-guess myself. That's so good.
So in mid-April, Adam, Dave, Robbie, and Jeff Ziegler packed the van and went down to North Carolina.
We obviously had like a great relationship with North Carolina. So we booked like 5 days at Mitch Easter's studio in Winston-Salem, Fidelatorium.
Was Mitch there? Did you work with him?
He was there, but the day that he came in, I was in the bathroom, which is fine, honestly. And he dropped off a Hagstrom 12-string. I think when people see Mitch Easter, they just want him to hand them a 12-string. So that's what he did, and I was in the bathroom. They were like, Mitch Easter just came in. I was like, oh, thank God.
Did you use the 12-string?
Yeah, I used it on Red Eyes. It's on there. Used it heavily. Yeah, I mean, that was a great studio. It was like so much cool esoteric gear, guitars, keyboards. They had a Chamberlain. They had a really cool, strange console. Beautiful, that beautiful Yamaha C3 piano. Is that what that's called?
I believe so.
That you played Eyes of the Wind on?
Yeah, that was a really nice piano.
Yeah, that was like, I think the second or third night, it was like dark. I don't even think we were like actively working on Eyes of the Wind, but Robbie just had the spirit and he was just playing the piano and we just basically set up a C37 and a stereo Bang & Olufsen mic. And just, he did like a couple takes of Eyes of the Wind and it was just like, I don't even think we talked about it. I think he did, we're just like, well, put the mics up, and then gave him a headphone mix and I think he did maybe one or two takes. I remember Dave did the bass to Pressure there, which was sick. On like the second day, cut the master bass on Pressure with his Tysco bass. And Suffering too, I think, sitting on the couch next to Brad. Brad Cook, on the third day he was there, we got pizzas. And he got like the suicide wings. Like it was a whole thing, like a whole bit. Like,
yeah, it was like the hottest wing in North Carolina. And he went there and had to sign this waiver to eat this wing, a single wing. And then he ate it and was just like moaning for 2 hours. Like, what are you doing?
We're back in the control room and like we're listening to Suffering. And it's like, you know, everyone's high and it's like nighttime and Dave's like sitting on the couch with his eyes closed playing bass to Suffering and Brad's like next to him like, oh! We're just overdubbing, you know, there wasn't much like structure, there wasn't much mixing or arranging, it was all just throwing paint at the wall constantly.
And then Matt from Bon Iver was there.
Yeah, Matt McCon.
Roundhouse Kick, yeah.
Back then, it was just like, just recording for the sake of seeing what happens, you know? I mean, it's like Matt McCon, like, probably spent 2 days doing drums on stuff. Suffering, Eyes of the Wind, Disappearing. I mean, I don't even know if I ever even listened to them after we got home. It was just like, let's cut another drum set. Back then, it was just like, if something didn't stand out as immediately magical. It was just like, all right, we'll just let's recut it some other time. You know, it wasn't like trying to make it work or anything to just keep the thing moving in like a fun, exciting direction. There was never really any overthinking about parts. It was always just like the string synth on Red Eyes. They had an Arp Selena, which I don't think I'd ever really used before. And I plugged it into like a Moog cluster flux and then 30 minutes later, there was like the part on Red Eyes, you know? But it wasn't really, we didn't really overthink it. It just kind of happened. But yeah, that was just a great trip. We went to Mitch Easter's, packed a van, went to Echo Mountain for 2 days. We had a like a long history with Echo. It's kind of where we would go to work. We'd get in the van from Philly, we'd drive to Asheville, and we'd go to Echo Mountain. And usually we would only work in the B room because the church was booked. But this time the church was free. Really amazing studio. The first day, we didn't do much. At night, I think I did acoustic guitar, like the basic track for In Reverse. We'd cut a version, obviously, in Hoboken, but I had refined it and then did it to a drum machine at Echo Mountain, just a vocal and guitar, like the full sort of song. But yeah, I don't remember what else we really did at that Echo Mountain trip.
Red Eyes, there's some sick Red Eyes guitars.
There is.
I mean, it's interesting, our memories, because you're telling me all these things that I don't really remember. But then a huge aha moment for me was, I can still, like, it's sort of a flashbulb memory of sitting on the couch in the church at Echo, and you just layered, like, layers of that lead on Red Eyes. And I remember Jeff and I actually looked at each other and were like, fuck. Like, you know, the song is sort of revealing itself to us. It had like a fun spirit to it up to that point, but that was the first time I was like, wow, this is like an anthem, this like guitar. And you kept overdubbing more and more and more of them. And it was just getting like bigger and bigger. And we were just like, fuck, this is so.
Oh, I do remember those, yeah.
Actually, now that I remember, that was where we did the Suffering guitars, the Leslie guitars. I forgot about that. I think we were talking about Robbie Robertson and the black box that Garth Hudson had made him, which was a fuzz pedal. It was a Ampeg Scrambler, which is a fuzz octave pedal, into a tape echo. Into the Leslie, and that's like that Robbie Robertson Leslie sound. And so I had a green ringer that Jesse had made me, Jesse Turbovich. So I had my fuzz, my green ringer, and then into my space echo. So basically trying to mimic the black box Robbie Robertson thing and just use my Les Paul.
The huge moment was when Adam sent me, I guess, the final mix of Suffering. And I had something relatively cataclysmic happened in my personal life, and I like woke up, and it was the kind of thing you wake up and just check your email, and I was feeling a lot of emotion in me already, and when the way they had mixed the that Leslie guitar, it was so loud. You know, I feel like in all the earlier roughs it had been kind of like politely tucked in the back, and then Adam and Nicholas, I guess, like cracked the code, and it just sounded so good. It was really wide. And yeah, it was just brought me to tears. It was just, it still does. It's a big moment. There's a bunch of flashbulb moments. It's funny because a lot of record making is sort of busy work or sitting around, like looking at menus of what you're going to eat next or whatever. And then you have these incredible peaks, like that moment in the church with the Red Eyes guitars or the Suffering solo, when I heard it kind of in its full, full regalia.
Talking back about these things really makes me feel like I have really bad. It's like Adam has such a great memory.
My
memory is so terrible. Like, I remember moments, but like,
same.
Not the details. No details whatsoever.
Do you remember recording the Ice of the Wind piano?
No. I remember the piano. I remember, I think maybe like Ben Folds recorded a record on it or someone, you know? And I was like, oh, cool, Ben Folds played this piano.
We also were drinking and smoking weed at a pretty crazy clip back in those days.
Yeah, under the pressure, I remember my girlfriend at the time, we'd gone out or something and then got home and I just wanted to work on this, work on music or something. Yeah, things just would happen really quickly. You know, you just like had a drum and just started messing around with the tape and the speed of my finger and holding the reel and then the intro. And
can you tell how you made that thing?
So basically had a hi-hat track from a drum machine, like hi-hat, kick, and snare, just playing the same beat over and over for about 12 minutes on the tape. And then I probably sped the tape up and had a digital delay pedal, my hardwire, on an aux send of my console, feeding back into two channels on the tape. Everything's relative, you know, so if you change the speed of the tape, whatever it's getting printed back, it's all the same, you know? So I think I just tapped the tempo of the, did a quarter note delay or eighth note delay on the hi-hat, and then maybe I slowed it down. Yeah, I slowed it down because that's why it was all fast at the beginning.
Were you printing into the computer while you were doing that?
No, I was printing, always printing it back to two channels of tape.
Okay.
So then you press record and play, and it's feeding itself. And then I just hit the vary speed button after 20 seconds. So then it snapped back to regular speed. The eighth note delay must have been to the regular speed. So that when you'd slow it down, it was all sort of like wonky. And then you went back. Because the Tascam machine just has a button for vary speed. So you could be like super slow, and then just hit the button, it would snap it back to regular speed. So you just hit the button, it would immediately go right back to real speed. I had lived in that house since early 2004. I mean, it was in total disrepair. The front wall where the album cover was taken, that we painted that, but basically everything from your waist down on that wall was just completely rotted out. If you touched it, it would just crumble. Yeah, a lot of them were written kind of right in that room. Eyes to the Wind, which at the time was called Out of Time. Yeah, Red Eyes, In Reverse. Lost in the Dream, I remember writing in that room.
My name is Dustin Condren, and I took the cover photo for Lost in the Dream, along with a bunch of other photos that were used for press and inside the booklet. Honestly, I was there for a couple of days, maybe 3 days, and we didn't really shoot anywhere. We shot in the practice space, but really it was almost entirely just in the house. I think that was the initial idea, was that he had this big space, that it had been instrumental in the making of the record, and he felt that that would be like the most appropriate place. The front rooms, I remember being pretty hard to just even walk through. Because of all the gear, which I thought was awesome. Obviously, it wound up being pretty photogenic.
The studio was kind of set up there until the end of 2012, and then I didn't really go down there for a solid amount of time. Like, even when I was living by myself, I was just, like, staying on the third floor of my bedroom. I never went to the front room. It was, like, haunted or possessed or something. Like, I had all the gear, but I never really went down. I actually brought it up to my room instead of going down there.
I mean, I slept in the house. I think Adam set me up in his room. Yeah, up on the third floor. And I remember, I mean, at the time, I mean, this was 2013, I guess. And I don't think I knew exactly, I don't think anyone knew exactly like how things were going to turn out with this record. And I feel like with Adam, there was really a feeling that like it could just all implode at a certain point. And I remember feeling like probably that wasn't going to happen, but at the same time, like who knew?
Are you comfortable speaking about like stuff you were going through at the
sure.
time? Because Robbie and I were just talking about like what we remember. You know, for me, a lot of the stuff I remember was sort of like a huge shift in your psychic state of being, or your psychological state of being, I should say. But, you know, like at Water Music, I remember you were really not doing great.
Yeah, I was fucked up.
One thing I remember was you were having panic attacks and you had like these Ativan in your pocket.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't take them because I think that was a scary thing as well, to like take a sedative.
Exactly. Yeah.
We were all kind of just watching it and not knowing what to do or how to help. When you're back.
I had panic attacks since I was younger, but they were like, you know, I may have one like every couple years or something. All of a sudden, you know, I was whatever, 32 years old, and I just started like, this is like every day. Like you just wake, like you go to bed like in a state of panic, hoping you don't wake up in a state of panic, and you'd wake up and you'd be just completely all day, just like that fight or flight thing. Like it's like all the time. It was like I never experienced that before, and once it started, it like it was just like a snowball that just kept getting worse. That was most of 2013. It was like the end of 2012 through basically all of 2013.
My memory was that we went to your house on your birthday, actually, I think. We had a rehearsal.
We were rehearsing for the studio.
Was that for Water?
Yeah.
It was like an early day rehearsal.
Exactly, yeah.
It was your birthday, and then we had some drinks or something, and then we watched the three-point contest.
Yeah.
Because Bonner was in it. And then we kept drinking, and then kind of went our separate ways, and it was like the next day, nothing was ever the same again.
Well, that was exactly true, yeah. Yeah, that was basically it. The next day, I mean, I think that, remember the day before, I think we did something on my birthday, and I was driving to pick up this Optagon that I had got on Craigslist for $40. And I was driving out to like Bucks County in my van, and like I just like on the highway had like a crazy fucking panic attack out of nowhere, and then picked up the Optagon, and then we all went to dinner at like Dimitri's on 2nd Street in Northern Liberties.
Yep.
And then and I was just like reeling. I was just like, you know, like come, you know, when you like come down from panic attack, you're like just exhausted. And then yeah, the next day we rehearsed, I guess. Yeah, just the next day it was like, yeah, it was like the first day of the rest of your life sort of thing.
Yeah.
I was also living alone, and not really leaving my house. The only place we would go is like we'd go to shows or the bar, but by that point I basically just stopped drinking because I didn't want anything that was gonna like make these things worse, you know? But I wasn't really leaving my house, had nowhere to really go. Dave and Robbie would come over once a week, we'd watch Breaking Bad, eat Indian food.
Yep.
Very much remember that.
I think that everybody has like different, you know, sees different things or sees things different ways sometimes. You know what I mean? Our time together would be like, was often light. And so I, you know, don't think that I necessarily like even felt the gravity of, you know, maybe how he's feeling sometimes, you know?
It's a pathetic thing to do, to go through old emails. I was just trying to like reacquaint myself, but it was interesting because first of all, none of the stuff I remembered about Adam's mental health stuff was evident in any way in the email. It's interesting because like my memory has this like Adam's going through all this crazy anxiety and depression, and then the emails, it's like, fucking sick! Song sounds sick! We're gonna crush it! It'll be amazing! Album's gonna be great! You know, it's like, it wasn't seeping into our communications in that level, you know? Mainly because it's not something we were probably comfortable talking about.
Packing up the van and like getting out of town was the only way to like, yeah, go deep on the music, but also like give myself a distraction, because like I couldn't, the second I was home, I was just like consumed with this constant anxiety and depression that I couldn't really escape from. And I never like, I ended up going on Dave's recommendation. I'd never been to a therapist before until that year. I started going and I think six, seven months later. And that was very helpful. Just getting in the van and going to Echo Mountain, yeah, it's like with a couple people, like your friends, obviously, working on these tunes. It just kind of made you forget about whatever else was going on for a week, you know? Then we'd come back and then we'd, you know, try to work at Jeff's here and there, but that was always a little challenging in terms of A, my own mental health, and also just in terms of knowing if you're what you were really doing. You know, we did a lot, but we were never working towards something per se. We were just like adding, which is helpful. That's part of it too. Charlie cut the drums to Eyes to the Wind at Jeff's sometime in April.
Going over to Ziegler's, you know, it was pretty comfortable there because it sort of just felt like friends hanging out. Like a train in reverse down a dark road. It's like, you know, one of Adam's superpowers, you know, he's like, I got this thing, and it's like, it feels like you. Like Wind just felt like the most natural thing for me to play, you know, sort of like, I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, I always love playing that song. It's just like that song in particular, when I'm playing it, it's like, it's that sort of like what my body is, that sort of feels like my body's comfort zone, like my default.
After about 8 months of working like that, it became clear that it was just going to keep getting harder to A, know where you were at, and also just the grind of working on this thing. And it wasn't like the album was like traumatizing. It was just like every day was unpredictable, you know? So it was really hard to also add making a record on top of that. But I mean, we did a lot of great stuff. You know, we had a really great system at Jeff's. We had a great piano sound and we had great guitar sounds. And it was just, when you take people out of Philly and you go somewhere, you can really hack away at something. And in Philly, you just, you know, everywhere you look, there's a distraction, you know?
I feel like so much too is, you know, like working on this sort of mystique of a studio or a place, trying to catch the spirit of a new place. It's, sometimes it's hard to catch a mystique or a spirit in like your bedroom or the same studio you've been in for months and months.
We would do weeks at a time, or like, you know, 6-7 days at Jeff's. We might have even have gone to Minor Street a few times in Fishtown, Brian McTeer's studio. But like, you know, we cut the drums to in reverse and Suffering there. In reverse, Charlie played, and Suffering, Pat played at Minor Street.
Yeah, Michael Johnson is, he's a pretty totemic figure in Philly music scene, sort of a guru and mentor for a lot of young musicians.
Michael Johnson worked at University of the Arts. He was in charge of the recording studios. He worked there as a day job, so he had all these, they had Pro Tools and they had H3000, they had keyboards and Moog, so... Like, I took pressure over there, and Michael put on all those, like, the ARP 2600. Just adding. We'd run stuff through the modular Moog. Michael came up with the disappearing, the loop on an Oberheim, on an ARP 2600, the bass part, basically. Before then, disappearing was this, like, kind of, like, meandering Lindrum thing. It had all the elements, but it didn't have, like, the thing. Michael was, like, adamant. He's like, I hear this thing. And he just did it a cut and then arranged it in the Pro Tools. I was like, oh, that's sweet. And then it was, like, there. And it was like, oh, now we can sort of paint on it, you know?
I personally have gotten a lot of people telling me how great the bass line on Disappearing is. and it ain't me. For the last 10 years, people have been like, dude, the bass on Disappearing is fucking incredible. I think I was playing whole notes, a whole note bass, just to give it like a little more like sub frequency. But the bass, for the record, is Michael Johnson on the 2600. In every music scene, there's all these like sort of unheralded people who kind of grease the gears on records and help out, and maybe don't get, you know, they're not necessarily charging a day rate. They're just there to help you. And he's definitely one of them.
Michael also will write to me when we're close to wrapping up any record, be like, make sure Adam gets me on this record. It's going to suck.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
After working in Philadelphia on and off during the spring, in June, the guys headed back to North Carolina for another session at Echo Mountain.
Echo was June... Motherfucker, piece of shit. June 23rd through the 30th.
I think we were going down to, like, try and finish something. Nothing got finished. But also, that was when we did vocals. Because that was just myself and Dave and Ziegler. I did, like, vocals for Ice of the Wind, Red Eyes, Lost in the Dream. Those were the main three that I did. I think the plan was to basically get the song queued up. Let's get it sounding pretty good. Let's do a vocal. And then it'll be done. That was kind of the dream. But things never work out like that. So we just ended up tracking more shit. Percussion, guitars, whatever. We were just doing stuff.
I remember doing the bass on Lost in the Dream there.
So John Ashley, who's the assistant at Echo Mountain, who we met the first time we recorded there in 2008, he was a drummer. He played drums on Lost in the Dream, Ocean. He was just there, and it was just part of the thing. Like, let's have, you know, John plays. He was like kind of our buddy. We felt really comfortable with John. But yeah, we were just kept working on the stuff. I just remember me personally, it just got dark towards the end of that trip. And then it got darker when we kept working through July in Philly. It was basically like I wanted to stop thinking about it because I was so like physically exhausted from always just being like in a constant state of panic or whatever that like I kind of just wanted to like stop thinking about the record. It was cool. It was like everyone I play it for was psyched on it. But I just didn't know what I was doing.
Was Burning the last one on? I remember you playing me that in your bedroom, like, and it was, I feel like we were far into tracking.
Yeah, Burning was July. Because I remember Burning was the one where I brought everything up to my room. I had a M-Box, so I had a must have had a laptop. Two-channel M-Box, and I brought up the Prelude and the Juno 106. And I had a couple amps up there, but I remember doing Burning in, like, an afternoon. I remember sending Dave what I had done to see if he could... Because I think you put bass on at your house.
No, in your room.
No, that's right. You came over and did bass. That's right.
Yeah, July 15th, you sent me the demo. Yeah, you sent me the demo for it. A lot of those songs were, like, pretty crystallized fast.
I remember I had the chorus I had written on the piano. I always kind of had, like, those chords and the melody. The first, like, the da-na-da was actually an idea I had worked on years before for Slave Ambient. And then I tried to write this song for a Super Bowl commercial. And I used that riff for that. And then somewhere in July, I put the two together, I guess.
Back in the day, I mean, me, Robbie, and Adam lived within, like, stone's throw of each other. And I forgot just how, like, kind of tight-knit and neighborhooded up we were in our friend group, and how, ironically, the recording of this record kind of obliterated that. Because the record exploded, and we were never like that again. You know, this was like, it just was just the end. It kind of made me quite sad for it, because the record was sort of a culmination of us all living around the corner from one another, and like, hey, get Charlie over here. He was just a pal. You know, everybody who was on the record was like a friend or just sort of happened to stumble in. It was just a really great time.
The burning in your heart. I'm a- Remember that crazy apartment you lived in, Robbie, right near the on-ramp, near the dog park?
Which one?
Yeah. I moved once a year for 12 years. I had 14 moves in 12 years, yeah.
You moved so many times, and that apartment, I just really remember that apartment from Lost in the Dream, because I went over a fair amount. You had your Whirly, and I'd bring my laptop in an M-Box. It was just like, plug the Whirly into this thing.
Yep, right in there.
And let's come up with some parts. I mean, Charlie on Ice of the Wind, like, it was like, hey, can you come over to Jeff's today and, like, do some drums on this idea? And then he comes over and he brings, I don't know, maybe a snare, you know? He might have just used whatever was mic'd up at Jeff's. You just run the track and Charlie just, like, was playing it. That's the only take. You know what I mean? He just did it. Charlie just came over that afternoon and did that.
Well, that approach was certainly taken to an extreme when it came to recording the drums for Burning.
I believe Mike Sneeringer.
Whoa, really?
Plays drums on that song.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah. What's the liner notes say?
Mike Sneeringer, inadvertent drums.
Oops, I'm on the album.
Yeah, inadvertent drums. Yeah, I think it was just like, it's possible I just had him play to a drum machine. We might have looped it. Because I don't think there's any fills, which at the time I was like very anti-fill. You came over to my room and played bass on Burning, and we just like went over to Michael Johnson's. It was just like...
There's so much popping in, so much osmosis going on from living close to each other.
Yeah.
Most of the records, but especially Lost in the Dream, were kind of like a product of their immediate environment. You know, like Burning, I did the bass in Adam's third floor room. I think I was like sitting on like a cardboard box or something. Adam has never ever pretty much said to me, hey, come down to the studio, you know, we're going to capture like a definitive baseline of this track. You know, he's never done that ever. He's always like, hey, come down, we'll hang out, you know, maybe you throw a bass on it. Like, always trying to keep things, kind of trying to sneak up on the moment. I mean, I've learned a lot from working with him over the years, but one of the biggest lessons I've learned from him is like, a lot of the most important stuff in music happens without it being talked about in any way. A lot of the stuff just sort of just happens and you don't even say anything. You just sort of, there's just a sort of magic and spontaneity about it.
It was around then in late July that I basically reached out to Nicholas Vernies because I saw his name on some Deer Hunter records. I didn't know where else to go. We were so embedded in like our friend group. I had worked with Jeff, so, like starting with Kurt, and then on Slave Ambient. And we went down to Echo Mountain for Slave Ambient and added stuff. And Jeff sifted through it for a month with us, and we finished that, you know? So then this record you start with, it just felt like I was scared to sort of like hurt anyone's feelings, you know? But I knew that I was like, if I don't have somebody else come in and sort of like help me finish this thing, I'm just gonna walk away from it because I was just exhausted of thinking about it.
It takes a lot of serendipity to make a record, a good record, a great record. And, you know, Vernhees kind of falling into our lap at the right time was a big part of it. You know, he was just the right personality.
I talked to Nicholas on the phone for like 2 hours. It was just cool to just talk to somebody about music, and I liked all the stuff he had been doing and talked about his studio. I didn't know anything about Rare Book Room. And so we made a plan to, you know, I think it would be in like 3 weeks. I think the first time I went up was in mid-August. And these are like timelines that like are so crazy to me now, because granted we tour more than we did, but now it's like we work on shit for like years.
I was struck by the same thing. In my memory, this record took like 5 or 6 years to make. And then I was looking back and I was like, this happened pretty fast.
Yeah, like from like the first band session at Water Music, it was done for the most part by the end of September. And that's basically mixed. It started with like, let's start with 5 days and see what it's like. And I drove up to Brooklyn. And the first thing we mixed was Suffering. And I remember like, you open up the session and within an hour, 2 hours, it started really sounding like a record. And I loved his control room. It just sounded great in there. These barefoot speakers and MCI console, tons of outboard. I mean, Nicholas had a ton of gear, but his friend Steve, who lived in Soho, he had a ton of gear. And it all happened to be at Nicholas's for this like 2 week period. And so we were using all this really amazing old tube gear coupled with like stems through his console. It just started sounding really good, really quickly. Nicholas was the one who, when those guitars on Suffering came up, he like turned them way up and put them through a compressor. He gave that song, because it was the first one we did, a real like identity really quickly. And I was like, let me just go do a quick vocal. And I just walked into the control room, did like 2 takes of a vocal. I walked over to his Rhodes and doubled the piano part at the end and did a couple things. We worked really fast, and then I was just like, cool, done. And then he would run a mix. I was staying at this Airbnb, and I would listen to it on my earbuds. And then the next morning, we'd go in and make a tweak, and then that was done. And we did that the whole week. The second song we mixed was Pressure. Same thing. It was like within an hour, like he got the drum sounding a certain way. And I was like, oh man, it sounds like, sounds good. It was just like tight and just like sounded really groovy. And I was like, oh man, this is awesome. So same kind of thing, worked on it all day, did a vocal through the 67. And then we ran John's sax through some amps at the end or something, like for that noise outro. And then it was like, cool, print a mix. Next morning, listen to it, mix this little tweak. Done. We did In Reverse on the last day. And In Reverse always had, from the beginning of the song, it had a drum machine and the acoustic was going. Like the song started with me kind of singing and strumming and the drums were in. And we just kind of like, I was like, just mute everything except a couple things, you know? We just muted like 80% of the session. And it was just these synths that I had done one night at Jeff's and the slide guitar thing.
They tell me where you're hiding, but through the haze there's no
And I was like, oh, that's it. And we had never listened to the song like that before. We had never, like, had music that was sort of like that.
Calling out your name in the dark.
It felt like a bold decision at the 11th hour. It just sounded like totally fresh, you know? And I was like, oh man, like I haven't been excited by this music like at all this whole year. And now I'm like, this is awesome, whatever this song is. And then we're like, well, what if the drums come in right here? And right at that moment on the track, Charlie had hit a cymbal. In the whole take, you know, we had muted everything up until that point. So when the drums come in, he had hit a cymbal. So it just worked out perfectly that, like, that's where the drums would come in. Nicholas, you know, he was really amazing about, like, trying to get to, like, the heart of the big picture. Like, the details weren't important. It was, like, the big picture. But within that big picture, there was, like, a few details worth diving in on, you know? And so he, like, dialed in the snare a little bit. We added like that third verse, sort of like he put a sock over my acoustic and I strummed that percussive acoustic thing. But it was all there. I did a vocal, basically improvised the third verse like on the spot. I never sang that evaporates and fades line until it came out. I was like, well, that was good, you know? It was just like one of those things. Third day we did Eyes of the Wind. Same sort of thing where it sounded really good, but we always had the vocal dubbed out like we did. Me and Jeff would work on music and we'd do a vocal and then you'd put an echo on it. So we had this song with this like kind of distant-y vocal and Nicholas was getting this song up and the first time he patched in that old 175 compressor was on that song, and he just put that on the vocal, and he said something to the effect of, oh, you're telling a story or something, I don't know. But it just put the vocal, like, just super loud. He took off all the, you know, all the delay and everything. And at first it was, like, kind of unnerving, but at that point I was just, like, so excited about actually somebody taking some liberties, I think, because we're just kind of going in circles the way we're doing it. So he was just sort of taking real ownership of music he hadn't really heard and didn't really know our band. But it's amazing how much different that song sounds when you just do that to the vocal.
I definitely remember Robbie and I being not sure about it at first. Just was such a radical shift from like 144 millisecond delay on the vocal, and then all of a sudden this is this huge stepping out moment, very dry, vulnerable, but it kind of galvanized the like whole spirit of the record.
fell away again. Like a train in reverse down a dark road, carrying the whole load, just rattling the whole way home. Have you fixed your eyes to the wind? Will you let it pull you in again on the way back in? I'm a bit run down here at the moment. Let me think about it, babe.
Robbie and I, we'd have some like one-hitter sidebars where we'd like listen to mixes and hang out in my kitchen. And I definitely remember that one being like, oh my God, is this okay?
But it was cool because Nicholas like was just, he was super musical guy. What I mean is, like, he loved music. We all loved a lot of the same kind of music. And just, he heard that song within 2 minutes. He was like, oh, man, vocals got to be right in the front on this one. You know, you're singing some nice words. And that was something that you just wouldn't do when you're surrounded by your boys of 10 or 15 years. You wouldn't really, like, take ownership in that way. Because he was also trying to impress me. He wants to, like, make an impression. He just did that to the vocal reel. That was like the only thing he kind of really tweaked, but it really defined sort of the whole record, if definitely the song. So the end of that week, it was basically Suffering, Pressure, Ice the Wind, and In Reverse. And I was like, this is great. So then I went back a couple weeks later. We still had like six other songs to finish though, which was stressful because I was like, what if I go back and it's a train wreck and then what are we going to do, you know? I had 2 more weeks with Nicholas in, must have been late September. I think Red Eyes was the most time-consuming because the drums were kind of whack. They sounded good on rough mixes, but when you tried to mix them, there wasn't much happening. So I think we ran the drums on Red Eyes through an SVT bass amp. And then also with like a snare in front of the SVT mic'd. We didn't have... like the second half, like the bridge, like all that stuff, that wasn't on the song until mixing. That all happened in the span of like 2 hours. Like the night before I went to New York to mix, we were at Ziegler's and Robbie came over and I was like, you gotta do the piano on Red Eyes just like with a little more urgency, like Darkness on the Edge of Town, like really slam those notes. So we did it, it took like an hour because he'd already done a piano on it. And then, like, when we're mixing it, you're just, like, making all these really quick decisions. And Robbie happened to be there. He came up to New York for a day and a half, 2 days. And he just jumps over on Nicholas's little, like, transistor Hammond organ, stuck a mic on the built-in speaker and just played that all that organ stuff in the bridge, you know? There was, like... kind of a skeleton of a song, and then like after we mixed it, it was like that was kind of the part that held it together.
Put it through the tremolope, right?
Yeah, tremolope, and we had the Roland 404 sampler on the aux. We just kept sending things to it. Yeah. when we were mixing with Nicholas, like, I'm still trying to, like, get back to that flow, which is, like, super fast. Bring up the song, get it sounding mildly good, add a couple things, mix it. I remember we brought up Burning, and I was like, I don't know, this... I felt like the luck was going to run out to Nicholas. And I was like, oh, this, they got this other one called Burning, and he brought it up. He's like, oh, man, I've been mixing this song for 15 years. It was all just, like, super fun. It was also not fun because I wasn't, like, there, like, enjoying it. Like, I knew it was working, but I was also, like, sort of spiraling mentally because I think it was also the culmination of everything that year and putting a, probably a lot of pressure on that time there working on this stuff. So I remember sitting in the park having a salad with Nicholas, just, like, feeling like I was just about to, like, explode, like, just not in a good spot. Definitely couldn't enjoy whatever creativity was happening, but I knew it was good. Like, I knew it was, like, better than what we had, or I knew it was, like, final. You know, I was like, oh, this is, like, a good sort of wrapping up of all this music, you know? Like, this feels like we came up here, made some cool last-minute decisions, went all the way and ran a mix, and it sounds cool. The only songs we didn't mix with Nicholas were Ocean and Disappearing. Ocean, the arrangement changed after the mix. We just didn't get it in Brooklyn. I didn't really know what the song was yet. And Disappearing, that's kind of, in retrospect, only a song that Jeff could have mixed at that time. Because its beauty is it's like how simple it is. If you try to, like, mix it, then it's gonna be like kind of cliche. But the way he did it, it was just all about mood. Without Ocean and Disappearing, which Jeff mixed in October, you don't have the same record without those two.
Oh yeah, I just saw an email from you about Ocean, which was basically like, oh yeah, here it is. Here's the final mix of an Ocean.
What's the date?
October 20th, 2013. With a little bit of fake mastering added so you can pump it. No suggestions, please, as it's done. Ain't going back ever.
What a loser.
Yeah, I know.
No suggestions. We had cut Ocean, like, so many different times in different ways. Like, for the first couple of months, there was, like, a drum loop that Eric Slick did. But then the tape ran out, so his drums ran out, and then the song wasn't over yet. And then John Ashley did them, but then the mix that Nicholas did, unlike Jeff's mix, which was also, like, Disappearing, like, very flat in the best way possible. It was, like, very hyped. Nicholas's, like, the drums were, like, pumping and... kind of tweaked the arrangement and recut a bunch of stuff, and I mixed it with Jeff. We did, like, 4 days on that song. I did all these guitar things, and he just mixed it like he did, which is, like, quickly and sort of just, like, even. Everything just sounded good. It wasn't like anything special, but because of that, I think it was, like, really important to the record. Everything that people did on the record was, like, the best version of themselves or something.
Ziegler was just like the best at layering paint. You just did these long weeks of overdubbing sessions, and then you go to Vernhees. Vernhees is like the expert paint peeler, but it wouldn't have worked as well if you didn't have all those incredible layers.
Exactly.
That's sort of the process. You like layering all this paint, and then you go to this other guy. He's like, scrape, 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 sculpt, sculpt, boom, done.
And everything that Jeff recorded was great. When we were at Echo Mountain, I mean, Jeff had access to, you know, a great console, great mics, and like those Leslie guitars on Suffering. I mean, you could make those really loud because they were really well recorded. And like the vocals that we did at Echo Mountain, you know, you could make them really dry and put them through that compressor because they were just perfectly recorded, basically, you know? When we would strip something back to reveal another layer of just synths, it was like, oh, these synths, like, they sound really great.
With the final mixes in the bag, Adam drove back to New York City to have everything mastered at Sterling Sound by Greg Calbi.
Must have been October of 2013. And I knew Greg a tiny bit, but it was kind of thing where he gave it the seal of approval. He was like, oh, this is really good. I was like, oh, man, wow, thank you. I hate it so much. I remember with Red Eyes, he was like, what if we make the choruses louder and brighter? I was like, yeah, sure. And then he did this thing where it's like he's like listening, and then he's like, I don't know. And he took out his cables and he put in different cables. Definitely sounded better. Like something happened to the gold cables he had. It was like one more guy taking great care in like what he was hearing. When I first got there, he was playing the stuff and he was like, I'm mixing Eyes to the Wind first. And the song, like the instrumental, The Haunting Idol, that's after it, is in the same key. And he had them both playing, but he didn't know that the other one was playing. He didn't know the instrumental was playing behind Eyes of the Wind. So I'm sitting on the couch being like, is this guy fucking with me? I don't want to tell this guy what to do. He's got a John Lennon note on the wall, but like, this guy's playing two songs at once right now. And after about 5 minutes, he's like, Greg, you know that there's two songs playing, right? And he didn't know. He's like, oh, really? I was like, and it sounded crazy because it's like totally insane. Like Eyes of the Wind with Haunting Idol playing behind it, but they're in the same key.
He was like, these kids today, man, he's fucking smoking some weird shit.
Yeah, like, man, this is some weird music I'm working on. And I think he might have even said something like, oh, yeah, I was going to say, this is weird. I was like, yeah, it's two songs playing on top of each other right now. But I'd be lying to myself if I said I didn't mind. Leave it hanging on the line. And then after we got that out of the way, and then it was like, and then he heard Eyes to the Wind like as it was supposed to be. And he was like immediately like, oh man, I love this music. And I was like, okay, now we're on to something. And then, remember, after we mastered it, like driving home, it's like,
I know what you're going to say.
You leave the mastering studio, classic thing, you leave the mastering studio with your freshly mastered record. And what do? You put it in like the CD player of your 2000 GMC van. And you just like completely melt down on the side of 95. I just thought the record was like totally fucked up and terrible. Like, everyone does it. You know, everyone listens to their masters the next, after they go to the session.
Yeah, you called me and you were from your van and you were like, the record's ruined. It's ruined. There's ground hum on everything. Nicholas and Jeff ruined the record. It's totally, it's totally destroyed.
Yeah.
I thought you were cracking up in the moment.
I definitely was. There was Groundhum on Universe. We did have to go in later and fix the Groundhum, I will say. It was from that Publisin delay pitch shifter. I knew there was Groundhum.
Your brain had Groundhum. You needed a ground lift on your frontal lobe.
Let's just say there was no phase flip. Yeah, there was definitely no ground lift. Everyone does that with their master. But it was a fitting end to sort of like, you know. Yeah.
Damn, all we did was record and hang out. Like none of the other shit that fills up our lives now is there. We just had this open expanse of time, you know?
Me and Jeff were best buddies, you know? And it was like just every day going to your buddy's house and I'm laying a bunch of shit on him about my brain not working and he's dealing with other shit. And if Jeff was like, oh no, I hear this vocal, like you're telling a story, I'd be like, the fuck is wrong with you, dude? What are you, out of your mind? You know, I was like, you wouldn't want to hear that. You wouldn't want that sort of intensity from your buddy, you know? Cause it's like, I was needed that later from a guy I'd never met before. There really was like just the culmination really of the 10 or 12 years of us living in Fishtown and being friends and learning music together, sort of, you know, and doing our own thing and coming together and being part of this thing. And even just, you know, the weekly Breaking Bad hangs were like, I looked forward to those. That was like, because I wasn't drinking, I wasn't really going out. It wasn't like you guys were going out all the time either. It was just like people were kind of starting to have relationships. Maybe, I'm not really sure, actually, to be honest.
The album comes out, and then it just became so popular that we just toured so much and kind of kept going and going and going. And it was like we never went home. Because then Adam essentially moved, I think, first to Brooklyn, right? And everybody's lives just change, you know? Like, I think when you're in the moment and you're hanging out and you're working on records and it all that stuff blends together. Like, there's not a big difference between hanging out or working on records. But you think it's going to last forever, and then, you know, your dreams kind of come true and the band kind of ascended to a new place, and it's just over. Weirdly, it sort of killed our old lifestyle.
Yeah, I think about that a lot because I in some ways, I often think it's like unable to know how to phrase it really, but that it was like in some ways the worst thing to ever happen to me was that record. But and so many amazing things came of it too. But it was also just, it caused such an abrupt end to probably, I mean, it was a terrible time, but it was also an incredible 12, 13 years in Philly, you know, and it just kind of just went up in smoke. But at the time, you know, talking about it now, obviously, it's like romantic, you know, but at the time, it did feel like maybe it was... No, it never felt like it was time to leave, but it was kind of inescapable. Just things got so crazy, and our schedule, we just were gone for 2 years, 2.5 years. After everything, I don't even know how I would have gone back to live in that house. I'm not really sure. And it's also not like the success of a record or touring. Like, it doesn't, like, you have to do the work, obviously, mental health-wise, to learn how to combat that sort of situation.
This is great. We got it all here, man.
Is that good stuff? Yeah, it seems awesome.
I think it seems great.
The super high quality podcast is put together by me, Dominic East, with a tremendous amount of help and support from Adam. Thank you to everyone who made time to reminisce, Adam and Dave especially, Robbie, Charlie, Dustin Condren, and everyone else whose name appears in the credits of this record. Obviously, they are also a huge part of this story, whether we mentioned their name or not. Thanks to Andrew Guerin for sprucing up the final mix. Lost in the Dream came out 10 years ago this March, and if you haven't listened to it recently, I highly suggest that you
pump it.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.